Welcome to Bitcoin ETC, your monthly pass to eToro's Crypto Spotlight, where we delve into the realm of prominent and well-rooted crypto trends that truly matter. I'm Anthony Pompliano, also known as Pomp, alongside Will Clemente, my partner at Reflexivity Research, and we're here to ensure you stay ahead of what truly counts. So buckle up and let's go. This podcast is for information and education purposes only and should not be taken as investment advice, a personal recommendation, or an offer of or solicitation to buy or sell any financial instrument. This material has been prepared without taking into account any particular recipient's investment objectives or financial situation and has not been prepared in accordance with the legal and regulatory requirements to promote independent research. Past performance is not indicative of future results.
All right, guys, bang, bang. I've got Will here. I thought today we could just do rapid fire, a couple of different topics. Will, maybe what we do is you throw out each topic, I'll riff on it, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, let's do it. Maybe we can just start with the halving, kind of your initial thoughts on maybe the, you know, the halving's impact on the market, or just kind of broadly, you know, I think the kind of contrast of some of the things we're seeing in terms of monetary policy, especially last time we saw USD JPY get bid up to 160 or sell off to 160. It's come back down. It seems like there's some intervention from Japan, but maybe we could talk about kind of the stark contrast of, you know, Bitcoin's kind of programmatic monetary policy with, you know, some of the things that we're seeing going on in kind of the traditional macro world.
Yeah. So the Bitcoin halving, you know, it happened, a couple of weeks ago at this point. I think it played out almost exactly how you would have expected based on historical analysis. So the guys over at Bitwise, Juan Leon, he did this analysis. And he basically said that the price of Bitcoin in the month before the halving had risen historically 19%. So 19% increase right before the halving. But then the month after the halving, it had only increased 1.7%. And so if you think about, you know, kind of that as a way to, you know, put this in perspective, it's like people get really excited about the halving, but it ends up actually in a short term, not really having that much of an impact. And part of that is just like, you got to kind of work it into the supply chain into the market. And so if you then zoom out, Juan pointed out that in the year following the halving, on average, Bitcoin has risen 3,200%, but the year before the halving was only 185%. And so it's skewed by the early years, but basically the takeaway is like in the month before the halving, price goes up much more than the month after, but the year after the halving is much higher than the year before the halving, right? And so like, why is that important? That's kind of what we've seen so far. We're already checking off the box that Bitcoin was up before the halving, but people think it'll be up much more after the halving. Then in the month before, it did run up. But so far post-halving, we haven't really seen that big of a price difference. If anything, it's drawn down. And so I think that it's just kind of like, this is one of those stats where you actually want Bitcoin to follow the historical, you know, kind of norm. Any sort of anomaly or divergence, if it was bullish or bearish, would actually be somewhat of a red flag and make you want to dig in deeper. But what did you think so far?
Yeah, so I think the kind of biggest thing is like Bitcoin's supply issuance or inflation rate is now lower than that of gold. So basically, if you look at the stock to flow ratio of Bitcoin relative to the stock to flow ratio of gold as kind of a measurement of the scarcity of the asset, if you will, Bitcoin surpassed that of gold for the first time ever. So I think that's a pretty interesting kind of ideological milestone or kind of talking point for people maybe looking to allocate to Bitcoin or people that have been in the kind of gold crowd for a long time, but have been kind of thinking about getting allocated to Bitcoin or kind of watching it from afar. I've been kind of in the camp of, we're probably going to get a bit of a sell-off. I said this on the Unchained podcast with Arthur Hayes into the actual halving. I thought it was kind of a nothing burger in terms of kind of the short-term price action for Bitcoin. I think, you know, anybody kind of expecting Bitcoin to just double in the days after the halving was a bit silly. But I do think, you know, you'll start to see the price impact over the coming, you know, 6 to 8 months for Bitcoin as, you know, that kind of cut in the supply issuance starts to have kind of a broad impact over time. So that's kind of how I think about it in terms of the kind of price impact, especially as, you know, you theoretically get more kind of RIAs or, you know, large pension funds or sovereign wealth funds potentially allocating to these Bitcoin ETFs. So that's kind of how I think about it from just kind of a pure, you know, price impact perspective. You know, it's something that you need to be wary of, especially for people that are allocated to the Bitcoin miners. So initially, right after the halving, we saw this massive jump in fees. Because an individual decided to buy the original Satoshi after the halving, or first Satoshi after the halving, for a couple million dollars, and that drove up fees. Then also runes got launched, which are basically, you know, like a variation of BRC20s created by Casey Rudmore. We saw that kind of drive up the fees right after the halving, but we started to see those come back down in the week or so afterwards. So far it's not looking great for miners, but of course, you know, if you get price appreciation from Bitcoin or kind of a resurgence of any of this activity around the L2s or on these runes or just different things that are theoretically going to be built out on Bitcoin over the next 6 to 8 months. I mean, we've seen a ton of these L2s getting funded and, you know, market basically DEXs for runes getting funded, all this type of stuff in terms of infrastructure for some of this activity on Bitcoin getting funded. That could be potentially interesting for the miners, but it's definitely something that you need to be wary of if you're allocated to these stocks, because so far we've started to see the miner revenues get cut in half, obviously, from the block issuance. And so far it hasn't quite had a huge impact in a positive sense. The other big one that I wanted to touch on was we've now got these ETFs that are launching out of Hong Kong and then also Australia. I know that you've spoken to a lot of these kind of, you know, big sovereign wealth funds or pension funds over in the East. Do you have any kind of insight in terms of maybe how you expect these ETFs to kind of play out? They also are launching an ETH one, but we can focus on Bitcoin. What do you think the sentiment will be from some of those entities, and, you know, how do you expect kind of the flows to par up against the U.S.?
Yeah, look, I think that there is a really big sentiment change post ETF approval. Like, there's regulatory clarity, although that had already existed. That was kind of like the nail in the coffin in terms of regulatory questions. But also, I think that people underestimate how long it can take for an organization to allocate to an asset. And so that is likely to play out over the next, you know, 18 months or so. Some organizations had done no work. Some had done some work and now are just starting to think about, you know, how they're going to express that investment thesis and how much and things like that. And then I also think that institutions are not immune to FOMO either. You know, there's a very real thing where if all of a sudden, let's say some of the best performing funds start to allocate to an asset, other institutions, they don't want to get, you know, fired by doing what IBM does, right? So they're just going to simply say, oh, so-and-so is doing this, I should do it as well. And you get kind of that momentum building. Now, it is this weird thing where Bitcoin's price as it goes up is actually de-risking Bitcoin. And so there is this reflexive nature to it. And so Bitcoin at, you know, 70,000 is more attractive to institutions than Bitcoin at 10,000. Because they're not looking at it as how high can it go. What they're actually looking at is like, what is the risk I'm taking? And because this is outside of my normal 60-40, you know, kind of portfolio, then I actually can get fired for making like a bad decision. And I think that's really what we're seeing that's a little bit different here is that now Bitcoin has crossed over that $1 trillion market cap. Bitcoin has now become something that is so de-risked in their eyes that they can begin to allocate. And the question is not, will they do it? Now the question is just how much will they actually allocate to it? What do you think?
Yeah, I think the interesting point on like the sovereign wealth funds, again, I don't have a ton of insight there, but we saw this headline last week of the U.S. was talking about transferring the $300 billion of frozen Russia reserves to Ukraine, which is pretty insane. You know, basically the U.S., if we go back to the beginning of 2022, when Russia initially invaded Ukraine, the United States froze their FX reserves again, which were roughly $300 billion. And the U.S. basically kind of pulled out the nuclear button in terms of how they could weaponize the financial system. And so I don't really think that they'll be able to, you know, utilize that to the extent that they did against Russia again. We've seen China accumulating gold for several years now, as well as Russia, but we've started to see that pick up over the last couple months. And I think, you know, with this new headline, it's just a good reminder that, you know, if you're within the U.S. financial system, your money or your reserves aren't really your reserves. And so I think there's probably a lot of sovereigns around the world that are thinking about, okay, how do I kind of get out of the U.S. financial system, or at least kind of divest slowly some of my exposure out of it for strategic purposes like this, especially if you're a country like a China or a Russia or the Saudis or whoever. So I think, you know, Bitcoin is the best bearer asset on the planet, you know, being decentralized, controlled by nobody. It's the purest bearer asset that you can move around the world instantly. So that's, I think, probably the biggest talking point that maybe you can derive from that. And something that maybe will kind of drive flows from sovereigns moving forward.
Absolutely. What other topics do you have?
The other one is the payments. So kind of crypto payments, but we can talk on that. We saw this big headline from Stripe. I know you've been pretty familiar with the business over the last 10, 15 years. Do you have any thoughts on that? And kind of how do you expect the kind of crypto payment landscape to evolve moving forward?
Yeah, so on the payments front, this is really interesting because I think that all eyes were on Bitcoin initially. And there's this idea of, you know, peer-to-peer electronic cash, right? I mean, literally in the white paper. What we have seen is that Bitcoin is still used quite often for payments. It's about half as popular as Visa. So if you just kind of use ballpark numbers, Visa does about $11 trillion or so in payment volume. Bitcoin does about six, give or take, based on the latest numbers that I've seen. Now, what is probably the more interesting story, though, is stablecoins. Stablecoins have now seen just as much as Visa, so kind of $11 trillion or so of transaction volume. Now, why is that important? Well, when you think about stablecoins and Bitcoin, if people want to transact, it is somewhat of a zero-sum game. Either you use Bitcoin or you use stablecoins. I've always said that, you know, until Bitcoin becomes a non-volatile asset or things are priced in Bitcoin, people should not be spending their Bitcoin. And that may be an unpopular opinion, but the whole idea of spending fiat is because the fiat is going to be debased in the future. So you actually are rewarded from a purchasing power standpoint by spending money today rather than saving it for tomorrow. In Bitcoin, it's the opposite. You are punished by spending Bitcoin today and not saving it for tomorrow. And so from that standpoint, I think that the big payment you know, kind of story is these stable coins. And you can see it in what Stripe announced. Stripe now has gone and said, look, we used to support Bitcoin. We stopped supporting it because it wasn't really working. It wasn't as popular as we thought it would be. But now they're back a couple of years later and it's with stablecoin support. And so I think that that's just them following the market, paying attention to the data and trying to figure out what do their customers want. And it's very obvious on a global basis, people want to use stablecoins.
Yeah, 100%. I completely agree. Yeah, I think stablecoins are for the foreseeable future going to be the kind of payment method for crypto being integrated into kind of the broader fintech landscape moving forward. I just don't see why people would want to use Bitcoin for payments. People are going to want to hold their Bitcoin for the foreseeable future. We saw some influx in activity around Lightning and things like that, but really, frankly, haven't seen, you know, like kind of explosive growth, although there was a fair amount of funding around Lightning-based projects last year. But it's kind of TBD on whether they'll challenge stablecoins. But for now, we've seen stablecoins be the dominant form of kind of preferred payment for people interacting through crypto. So we got this comment from John Collison, who's the co-founder of Stripe. He said, crypto is back. Stripe will be supporting global stablecoin payments this summer. Transactions will instantly settle on chain and automatically convert to fiat. So pretty cool to see, you know, one of the leading payment providers in the world integrating crypto. I guess one interesting point to kind of touch on, they're focusing on USDC, which is seen as the more regulated US-based stablecoin, and they're going to be focusing on Solana, Ethereum, and Polygon. So there's been a lot of people that have been talking about how Solana has, you know, very high throughput, you know, low fees, et cetera, and makes it very advantageous for payments. And so it's cool to see Stripe also starting to kind of reflect some of that sentiment. So we'll see if this continues to drive activity for stablecoins. But, you know, overall, I think you and I both are pretty excited about stablecoin growth moving forward. We saw stablecoins bottom out towards the back half of last year. They're up about, in terms of aggregated supplies, they're up about $40 billion since. Some of that is just people looking to participate on chain and conduct, you know, activity through DeFi, et cetera. I think also it's a lot of it is, you know, people just looking to get access to dollars in a permissionless way through a digital wallet. So very exciting stuff. I guess another topic we can maybe dive into is the tokenization of crypto. This isn't one that I've been paying a ton of attention to, but we have seen a lot of growth in, you know, some of these RWA protocols and obviously Larry Fink going on television, things like this. Do you have any kind of, you know, deep detailed kind of perspective on this or any strong opinion on kind of tokenization?
Yeah. I mean, look, I back in, I think as early as 2017 was saying tokenize the world, right? And I think it's going to happen. And a lot of it is because the technology is superior. I've gone as far as to say that I literally think that they are going to write a lot of the rules of the financial system into code. And so the example that I've always used is like, if I hold a security and I shouldn't transact it with a non-accredited investor, well, if your wallet is a non-accredited investor and I hold the security of my wallet, then the code should prevent me from transacting with you, right? Rather than them retroactively coming and trying to figure all this out, doing it in a proactive way becomes pretty simple. I also think that people drastically underestimate the kind of automation movement. And so, you know, you can think of stablecoins or Bitcoin as like money for machines. With instant settlement times, now all of a sudden you can have true automation. If you have to use a two-day settlement time to transact, well, the machines have a hard time doing that, right? And so I just think that every asset is eventually going to be, quote-unquote, tokenized in the same way that we went from analog paper assets to electronic assets. Now what we are going to see is these digital versions. That doesn't mean that like every shit coin is going to go become popular. It doesn't mean that everyone is going to just be launching, you know, meme coins and like that's the future. It just means that it is a technology improvement on the underlying assets. And so, you know, the stock market should be open 24/7, 365, and people should be able to transact with 0-day settlement times. That is nothing to say about the actual asset. And it's just like that should be the standard in terms of kind of these very nuanced, intricate, you know, kind of underpinnings or infrastructure for these financial assets. So I think it's coming. Obviously, if BlackRock and others are talking about it, that you know gives it a tailwind. And I think the big question is just like, when is it going to happen, more so than whether it will happen? What do you think?
Yeah, I think there's a big question around, you know, how the value kind of maybe accrues to some of these tokens. But I do think there's a pretty good likelihood that we see some of this financial activity move on chain. And some of the things you just highlighted, you know, the 24/7 settlement, I think is the biggest one. And then also just, you know, being able to have kind of permissionless ability to interact with some of these financial instruments that are coming on chain. So I feel like it's kind of an inevitability. It's kind of up in the air as to, you know, which chain will see be used for some of the stuff. Obviously, recently, BlackRock announced a tokenized fund on Ethereum. You know, it's still up in the air whether we'll see some of these institutions maybe launch their own chain. Will they use Base that's associated with Coinbase because they trust Coinbase and have been using them for things like custody and some of the staking products? So I'm pretty excited about tokenization, but I think the big question is, you know, how does the value kind of accrue and how do you kind of think about allocating to some of the stuff?
Yeah. Well, and also I wonder how much, you know, are these technology changes, like, is there actually a difference in the return that can be captured? You know, a great example is like the first people who figured out how to trade stocks on the internet versus kind of open outcry method by calling your broker on the phone. Like technically they had an advantage. It didn't mean that the stock price was different, but like they had a speed advantage, right? And so if you could like move quicker, maybe you could drive a better return, but the asset prices didn't necessarily change that much. You know, is there stuff like that that's going to happen here? It's going to be hard to really tell until we see it. No, I think that the only other thing that I've seen is there's a lot of like bickering online now, right? Prices come down a little bit. Everyone's had a euphoric first 3-4 months of the year. And I think that people just got to remember, like just stay out of the riffraff, like stay out of the fray, right? And remember that like asset prices are going to go up and down, but it's really about the long-term view here. And so it's very easy when prices come down a little bit, especially kind of post-halving, we go into the summer, if things go sideways for a while, it's kind of like, don't get distracted, right? And just focus on, you know, whatever your strategy is, continue to do that. And historically, we've seen that you'll probably end up being fine.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, just as a reminder for anybody listening, you know, Bitcoin went sideways for basically 160 days. After the halving, I just pulled it up on my screen before it really started to run up last cycle. So, you know, I don't think that, you know, not seeing kind of a reaction post halving should be an immediate concern. Again, I think the real impact in terms of kind of marginal sell pressure from the halving really starts to show months out as that starts to get churned through over time. It's not, you know, a slight decrease in the supply issuance relative to the amount of circulating supply or kind of trading volume that's going to, you know, cause Bitcoin to rip in the couple of weeks after the halving. And, you know, it'll kind of take time for that to really start to, you know, show as an impact on the market. So totally agree. You know, wouldn't be surprised if we saw kind of a sideways summer, but, you know, I think kind of patience is the name of the game. We, you know, we saw Bitcoin go from 16,000 to 70,000 and, you know, less than a year without any real major pullbacks that we're used to in Bitcoin, you know, these big 30% plus wipeouts. So, you know, if we have one of those between now and the end of the year, definitely wouldn't be surprised. If we went sideways for a while, also wouldn't be surprised. But you know, I tend to think that Bitcoin's got a lot of tailwinds in terms of kind of the broader macro situation with kind of the, you know, the debt and fiscal situation in the United States. But then also, you know, over time, as the halving starts to have an impact on some of that marginal buy sell pressure, then we may start to see some appreciation towards the back half of the year.
I think that's right. All right, where can we send people to find you on the internet or find out more about Reflexivity?
Sure. My Twitter is WClementiIII, and then you can find Reflexivity at reflexivityresearch.com, and then be sure to check out the weekly report that we send out to the eToro user base as well.
All right, we'll do this again next month, my friend.
All right, thank you.
You've been listening to Digest and Invest by eToro. For more information, use eToro.com.